reading from verse 7, the angel said to me, "Why hast thou wondered? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman, and of the beast which carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast which thou sawest was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss and go into destruction. And they who dwell on the earth, whose names are not written from the founding of the world in the book of life, shall wonder, seeing the beast, that it was and is not, and shall be present. Here is the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains whereon the woman sits. And there are seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain only a little while. And the beast that was and is not, he also is an eighth, and is of the seventh, and goes into destruction. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have not yet received a kingdom, but receive authority as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and give their power and authority to the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him, called and chosen and faithful."
Well, we had a very interesting practical digression, but now I'd like to learn what are the seven heads, what are the ten horns, what's the distinction between the beast and the woman, and such.
The seventh
thing
we will explain further, don't
we? Well, give an explanation, please.
Before we get to the explanations, there is the statement about the beast itself, you see. And then after that, we get down further down into the explanation of the seven heads and the ten horns.
So there's no obligation to follow my order, but at the end of verse 7, it speaks about the seven heads and ten horns. And then in verse 8, it speaks about the beast. So that's what I followed, but I'm happy either way.
The only thing I was just thinking, you see, really was that in verse 9, you see, it says, the seven heads are seven mountains for the woman sits. But before we get there, you see, it speaks about the beast which you saw was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss and go into destruction. I just wondered if, you know, going down the new values to one, say, seriatim, whether we should dispense with their sake before we go into verse 9, but we're in your hands then.
Perhaps verse 7 gives us a list of the matters to be considered, and we begin with the beast, verse 8. As an introduction, and others will help in the absence of so many, the beast, which thou sawest, was, and is not, and is about to come out of the abyss. In some ways, we have an advantage over John. At all times, the secret of the Lord is with them that fear him, but we're in a privileged position where we're able to look back upon some of these things which for him were still in prospect. Was would seem to refer to the Roman power, and we see that three events are noticed. Was, past tense, is not present, and is about to come future. This beast is none other than the beast of the 13th chapter, but also the beast of John of Daniel. It's the Roman beast, and we seem to have here, in a very quick form, the history of the Roman head. The Roman Empire, as we well know, in AD 476, came to a conclusion under the Goths and the Gangl, under the invasions from the north, and the Roman Empire ceased, but having been in abeyance for centuries, it's about to come up, and this time it's going to come up out of the abyss, a source never yet seen before by any empire or kingdom. It seems to be a brief summary of the events, past, present, and future, and this would perhaps engage the brethren's attention as an introduction.
The beast as being an empire is something which is found clearly in Daniel 7. We probably have no time to go into the details of Daniel 7, those who want to look at that, but it is clearly said over there that it's in a succession, there are four beasts and there is a succession of empire, character. And at that time, it's empire which have authority upon Palestine, the land of the people of God. And in this sense, the four empire of Daniel 7 are rather important. And the last empire in Daniel 7 goes up to the end. The last empire of Daniel 7 is a strange, unique, awful, terrible, and the character of beast is essential to have no connection with God, no looking upwards to either to God or to heaven, and on the contrary, just looking at earth, and I repeat, having no relation with God. And that's what has been for the previous empire. Now, here, as it has been said, it's, we have again the same empire as the last of Daniel, and it is said that the beast was and is not and will come, and that's exactly what has been for this Roman Empire. It was in the past and ceased to exist, and there is all likelihood that it is coming again those days, and that's likely what we are seeing, even now we have not to base our faith upon the present event.
There's one thing that interests me, Daniel, is that certainly at the time John was writing, the political center of the empire was in the city of Rome at that time. The religious center was more in the eastern part, wasn't it? Then, very soon, of course, Constantine, and even before him, the political center was moved to Constantinople, and that really became the religious center. And in fact, the Church of Rome, as we know it, the Bishop of Rome, was at breakaway from that system. The Greek Orthodox Church considers the Roman Catholic Church to be in schism. So, really, although we've been quite rightly pasting the Roman Catholic Church, the real basic original one is the Greek Orthodox. Now, it may well be that certainly all of these things are being respite to the Lord Jesus, but it is one significant matter is that the Church of Rome actually worships the Virgin Mary. But when you examine the teaching and speak to Greek Orthodox people, they say they are venerating that Virgin Mary is not actually worshipping her? And is it perhaps because the chapter 1 has gone further and is actually worshipping the Virgin Mary that they get into this terrible position of abomination? Is that the reason for it, perhaps?
But there is perhaps something even worse than that. They attribute the motherhood of Mary to God, which, I mean, is intolerable.
It also seems that it has imperial ambitions. And through its missionary effect to the Royal Mansion in South Africa and so forth, South America, and that's quite like Rome itself. The Roman Empire. So there seem to be two concepts which the same concept coincides with the two systems.
As what we have in the seven heads. It's interesting that it's a little bit unique here that the symbol which are the heads have two meanings, and it is expressly said that there are two meanings. First nine is seven mountains, first ten is seven kings. Now, the image picture of a city of an empire with upon seven mountains is beyond any doubt wrong, and that was in history, literature, and everybody at that time. It was the classical way to designate Rome, the city of the seven hills. And it is used here to designate Rome without any doubt. But we have to remind us that the prophecy is rather, I would say, the time of the church, time of the grace, present time, is a parenthesis inside the prophecies. Parenthesis why? Because the church is connected with heaven and prophecy is connected with the earth. And there is no hope. We have said that there is clearly no earthly hope regarding the church, and the church has according to the thought of God, have nothing to do with the earth, only with heaven. And in this sense, this what is presented here has nothing to do with the existing church. We may see, we may discover already some feature which are similar to what we are finding here, but the direct explanation is not in in the present year, either religious or political.
There's a little point of translation which throws some light upon the passage. If we look at the end of verse 8 in the ordinary King James, the wording is, was, and if not, and yet is. Now the Darby translation makes an important correction here. It was, and is not, and shall be present. Now I think that helps greatly in understanding the passage, because we notice two features in connection with this under consideration. In verse 8, we get the important additional fact that it's about to come out of the abyss. Now, quite clearly, what's in view here is the beast in a character which is diabolical. Now, it's because of this, we find in the same verse that there's going to be a company who are going to wonder seeing the beast. And who are they? They are those that dwell on the earth dwellers. So that there's a correlation, is there not, between this beast that's about to appear in the prophetic page
and also the reaction of those who are under the influence of Satan. They're going to wonder at this feast, and they'll set in motion the considerations that we get from the rest of the chapter. I think that's a very important change in the text at the end of verse 8, and shall be present. This is going to be the character of the feast at this particular time.
And we've had this phrase, they who dwell on the earth, several times in Revelation. But here it really it adds that whose names are not written from the foundation of the world in the book of life. I'm just wondering why that phrase, you know, is brought in at this particular juncture.
The only suggestion we made, I think, is that we must at all times in reading these scriptures keep before us that God has a different company in prospect. If we were to limit ourselves only to the black side of 17, we would indeed come away in quite a depressed way. But there's another company. Their names are written in the book of life. And if we were to turn over to chapters 19 and 5, we'd see what a wonderful prospect is in view for them. So I think this type of contrast is something that we've got to keep constantly in mind as we go through these rather dark passages. As being out of it, we can appreciate better the awfulness of being in the situation of things.
And to confirm that it is another company than the Christian of the present of the time of grace, is that this wording from the founding of the world, because the Christian are before the founding of the world, and what is from the founding of the world is typically connected with the earth, and the Christian who are true believer, when we say Christian, it's of course true believer, are only connected with heaven, and then they go back before. And my recollection is that there are five things before, which are before the foundation of the world. There is the love of the Father and to the Son. There is John 17, I believe. There is the grace which has been given to us, probably to Timothy chapter 1. There is the aging, and I don't remember the last.
There are, of course, another three that can be included as having been before time began, you see. So the total number is 8. It's not necessarily before the founding of the world, but it's before the founding of the world and before the beginning of time. There are 8 of them, you see, and 8 is the number of new creation. You have to have Mr. Darby's translation, of course, to get the 8th one, which is in June, in the very end of June. But it is an interesting study, and we really love it to look at these verses.
It occurs to me that the reason why it refers to those not written in the Book of Life in connection with Babylon is to remove all delusions. If you think you can be saved by belonging to such a religious system, well, this verse says it's not so.
Moreover, God is going to take glory to himself on earth as well as in heaven. Referring to your problem, this is a very good subject and address, by the way. It's a wonderful thing to see the position of the assembly as heavenly character. But God is going to take glory to himself in respect of the earth as well. I think that's what's particularly in mind here.
Now, there are two kinds of kings. There are the 7 kings in first time, which correspond to the 7 heads
of the beast, five are fallen, one is the other has not yet come. And there are the ten, and not seven kings, but the ten kings of verse 12. It appears that the ten are simultaneous. The seven kings of verse 10 are clearly successive. Five are fallen, one is, the other not yet to come. The ten of verse 12 are clearly simultaneous. They receive authority as king 1 hour with the beast each. So it seems that the proper interpretation is that the seven kings are seven successive forms of government, and the ten kings are a kind of federation. Now, we are impressed, of course, seeing those days Roman Empire in developing with several kings under a kind of federation, and that's impressive, and that's may give some light to understand what is sharing this authority with the beast during 1 hour. But even there is some similarity, we have not at all to base our faith, I repeat, upon what we will see under the present event. And there was an appreciated brother who said, even if suddenly you would see no longer any common market, no longer any federation, no longer anything like that, your faith shouldn't be shaken.
Before that gets developed a shot, I'm going to come back to your earlier remarks in verse 9. Just as an aside, of course, and you want me to put this in the proceedings, it's of interest that the city of Edinburgh is set upon seven hills. Isn't that right, Charlie?
I haven't got to
them. I thought you came back. Yes, anyway, the city of Edinburgh is on seven hills, but that's an aside. The more important matter is here, you seem to indicate that these are physical mountains. Earlier in this book of Revelation, we've been taking mountains to mean sort of political countries and things like that, not physical matters, you see. I wonder, given the fact that we have the group of seven today, you know, the group of seven nations, you know, I wonder if there's an allusion to something that continues in the future. These group of seven, presumably, will be there. Maybe what will be there in the future is this, the basis on which the woman sits, on the economic strength of that group of seven.
You are right.
That we have to be careful to take symbol suddenly in a material sense. When around that we are taking them in a figurative sense, and you are right that there is a question. You have cited Edinburgh, I have heard of Moscow and other cities like that. There are certainly many cities with seven hills. Now the reason I believe we can nevertheless use this interpretation, this meaning, was simply and just very simply that it used to be a very, very classical and ordinary name of Rome, the city of the seventh mountain. So that was just well known even to John and the people of that time.
Just a brief answer to that question that I'm showing is that the symbol, when this is interpreted, the interpretation must be real, no longer a symbol. You don't interpret a symbol by another symbol, do you? But I want to question, I'll ask you a question, and that is this. What point of time is this verse 8, I'm going right back, used? Because the time that John wrote this, had this vision, the beast that thou sawest was, it doesn't connect it with is, it's still present, wasn't it? The is not, that is the present time we're living in now. Now, what point of time was this used?
Is the possible answer that we have to view the prophecy in a time sense? We can view the was and is not quite clearly because of what has happened in history. And I just wonder whether John was taken outside of himself for the sake of those who'd be the readers.
I was wondering whether it was from the point of view the church had just been taken up.
Yes.
And the Roman Empire still has not come. It still is not. That's still moving.
There has been another suggestion, as you probably well know, that there was. It wasn't really actually the beast, but it was, say, for example, the Roman Empire, and then the beast will be, a sort of pattern on that own Roman Empire with its political systems and things like that. So it's strictly the laws, but it's not actually the beast. It's a pattern of a political system of organization. And then that went away, as we know, and there were several attempts to revive it, such as under Charlemagne. Perhaps Bishop can help us on that one. Charlemagne with his whole Roman Empire, and Napoleon Bonaparte and things like that, attempts to revive it, but these were not right. When the beast actually comes, this will be based on that, and there will be a more full flower of it. You think that's what's meant here?
Would be a possible explanation to say that, without fixing it too much to the time of John, that these are simply three stages of an empire? It used to exist, it ceased to exist, and it will exist. And as far as I know, this is very rare. If there is any other case at all, the typical pattern is that civilization emerges and it disappears. But I wouldn't know of other cases where civilization emerges, disappears, and then reappears. So that without fixing it too much to the time of John, we could simply say the remarkable thing is that there are these three stages.
Mm. Well, you do have this with Babylon. We have Babylon under Nimrod, and then Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar is really the Neo-Babylonian period. That's how archaeologists view it. But anyway, that's just an example. I don't think that this Babylon is, it has the moral traits of these things, but it's not the revival.
Further reason to support this idea of three stage is that in verse 10 we have one of the king which is. So it would be rather strange that the beast is not, and nevertheless the king is.
I agree with the thought that there are three stages. On the other side, it is important to make a distinction of the point of view. On the other side, it is important to make a distinction of the point of view taken in deciding when the third stage will begin. Here in verse 8, it is from the point of view of the Lord. Here in verse 8, it is from the point of view of the Lord. When, as Brother Daniel has said, when the diabolical character has been manifested. There is another example that can help us to understand these three stages. It is the state of Israel itself. If you look to Ezekiel 37, you will see that there are in the restoration of Islam, two stages. One stage is in the indirect government of the Lord, when the prophecy of the valley of the dead bones, when by the indirect government of God, the bones are coming together, and this is what we are seeing nowadays. Israel has been brought back to the land Canaan. But the second stage, that the Spirit of the Lord will blow into this this country, it has not happened. And this is the stage that counts for the Lord. And similar thing we have with this kingdom, with this Babylon. We are looking now the period of the indirect government of the Lord, where we have we see the kings and the authorities. And in verse 12, we see the point of view of man, that the beast will get its authority from the 10 kings. But one who has the wisdom discerns that according to Revelation 13, the real authority will come from the devil. So, and that is what comes. So at this moment we see the indirect preparation of Western Europe, but the period, the third period we read here in verse 8 will start when Revelation 13 will be fulfilled. The church is raptured, the devil will be thrown from heaven, and you will know that his time is short, and when the devil gives its authority to this kingdom, then the whole thing will start, and we have the third stage mentioned here.
We did have the city in three parts in the previous chapter. Another three.
Brother Rashad, when you were talking about these seven kings in verse 10, you didn't see, whether these really are seven successive empires, or whether they are seven different forms of ruling. We had on the Roman Empire, for instance, so from the Roman Empire we had kings and decemvirs and tribunes and dictators, and the form that was there was an emperor in the time of the emperor then, and after that, after the emperors went, there was yet another form of government in Rome. Is it that type that's here, or is it seven successive empires? The one is being the Roman Empire at that time, and one yet to come. Which is it?
It's the first
of what you have mentioned. No, why it is the first? The beast is the same, there is just one beast. Yeah. So, it's just the seven, the beast is the same, it's just the seven heads which are changing. So, global nature is not changing. Now, what is it seems to be there is when we compare verse 10 and 11, one is the other has five are followed, one is it. You have cited various forms of government, and one is certainly the imperial form which was at that time. The other has not yet come. And then when we compare with verse 11, there is a wording which is very close, very similar to the beast that was and is not, and is also an eighth, and is of the seven. But is it looks like that there is an identification of the beast and the head of the beast. That, I would say that's That's the difficulty of this verse, and I think it's the proper interpretation is to recognize an identification of the head of the beast and the beast. And this is also, it has a moral bearing in the sense that really the global empire gets its true character from its head. And that's when the in chapter 19 the beast was taken and cast alive into the last lake of fire. It's not the beast as global empire, it's this head.
We bear in mind the image in Daniel that the two legs were iron and clay. And that, I believe, suggests that there is the imperial form of government as well as the democratic form of government. So, let us mention that for.
May I offer what, in my own mind, has been clear, and if the brethren don't like it, I'm sure they will put me right. In verse 9, the seven heads, seven mountains. I have always understood this to be a reference to Rome. When I was in Germany the last time, I was in Siegen, and the German brethren will know what I'm talking about. It also is a city upon seven hills. It's not only Edinburgh, it's Siegen as well. But I think it's quite clear with respect in verse 9 that Rome is being spoken of. This is the location of the beast. Now, so far as verse 10 is concerned and the seven kings, I have always been brought up on the truth that it's five successive forms of government. And I think tracing it out in the history of Rome, some of us who had to do Latin at school had to learn the history of Rome as well. And I jotted down the various heads, five of them, kings, consuls, decemvirs, dictators, decemvirs, and military tribunes. There's five of them. Now, the one that is the Caesar. Now, I find that completely satisfying. It's five different forms of rule, so far as Rome is concerned. But clearly now, we're coming to a new era. And I think the distinctive character of this comes out very clearly in, first of all, he that comes must remain only for a short time. This would seem to have its early picture in the temple, Napoleon Bonaparte. Everybody sees him as one who's arising out of the sea, has power for a short time. Well, those were attempts only to restore the Roman Empire, and as you pointed out, they failed. But I think that the one who continued for a short time is best seen in Napoleon Bonaparte, because he's a little figure of the one who is going to come. And it says that he is of the seven, in other words, he partakes in many ways of the character of the previous Roman power, but this time he's an eighth. There's something distinctive about him. Now it's along those lines that we can understand the force of his coming up out of the abyss. There's something very special about this man. He's going into destruction. Now I suggest that at least that far it's fairly clear and simple, at least in my own mind. And if others don't think so, I'm sure that would be right.
In the time where there is no universal empire.
I think that's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned that, Edwin, because in the time of the original Roman Empire, they wouldn't have countenanced for one moment 10 kings. They were all under the rule of Rome. Any suggestion of any challenge to them would have been put out at once. You see this in the act. If there's any trouble, it will be squashed. But in the coming day, then these 10 kings are going to receive authority 1 hour with the beast. They'll be separate, distinct kingdoms. They will be separate with the beast in control, doubtless. But nevertheless, these kingdoms are also separate kingdoms. This is again a refute referring to the prophetic future.
Men have always aspired to universal dominion, it appears, just in, for instance, the British Empire, and then most of the globe was painted red, and then when that collapsed, communist empire arose, and then large parts of the globe were painted red, but that's all shattered. So we're really in a period where there still is no universal, although much was red in both cases, wasn't universal. And that was the feature of the Roman Empire. Everything it saw, it brought within its authority. Even if they put a wall to divide the Scots off from the English, it was really to keep the Scots under control.
But this leads on to verse 13, and we can hasten forward so quickly. The remarkable thing is that these 10 kings all have one mind. That's an extraordinary thing. Let's see. That's difficult enough to get clever enough to agree. But here we find 10 kings agreeing. And it's quite obviously under the influence of power of the devil. And this, of course, is going to end up with the awful climax, which we see here, of making war.
Was found really at the beginning of Rome, in about the 5th century, when the five villages, I think the names of these hills, are Capitol, Palatine, Cilicia, Esquiline, Fimbria, Quirinia, and Aventine. When these five villages were united,
ab urbe condita, and I think that was 753
BC,
was it not?
Yeah. Well, yes, but I don't think there were five villages united then. I think it was a little later when these five were united into one community. And so this concept of a confederation, even though it was quite localized then, is really the concept that dominated the growth of the scheme, and that's what we have here, where this men, the 10 are of one mind. It's a confederacy concept.
I don't like to refer to present thing generally, but just to help to better understand, probably everybody knows that at the present time, you have each country has the chairman during 6 months in term. So it's typically what we have here to have authority 1 hour with the beast. Now, it may change. It's not sure at all, but. It's nevertheless giving an idea of what can be. And in my sense, it's the reason of Percy Evan when he said that the beast is an eighth and is of the seven. It's something which is totally new. It's both old and high and totally new. And in this sense, I have a chance, but I am very tempted to see Napoleon therein, but just for the simple reason that it's a past history connected with the earth and it's not future. But anyway, they have one mind, and you say it's surprising, but unfortunately, it's the David which gives the one mind, and that's terrible to reach this situation only by such a means.
That's very, it was very helpful reference to by you and Daniel to this matter of you said that the brethren can't even be of one mind. And it's merely because we're trying to have that sort of mind that's here, which is a political mind. And we're doing political offspring to get the one mind. Maybe we should be doing what's in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And again, I don't want to parade the Greek, but it's a different word, isn't it, there for mind that we have in Philippians 2 and verse 5. And, sorry?
The way of thinking.
It's a way of thinking, that's right. Right. And perhaps, dear beloved, if we get the mind of Christ, you see, that's really what we're missing. We're going after a political mind like this. A compromise, horse trading, but it should be the real mind of Christ. Do you remember, sorry, Brendan, I just wrap it up. There was two brethren had some dispute, didn't they? And afterwards they seemed to be in agreement, and somebody said, well, who got their own way? And they said, neither of us. It was Christ's way.
The early brethren used often to say, did they not? You've got to lose your own head if you're going to hold that belief. I think that's quite a useful expression. Lose your own head in order to hold belief.
I'd like to suggest that the mind in Philippians 2 is the attitude that should mark us. But that in itself will not produce the unity of which Scripture speaks. It is the reference in current 1 Corinthians. Ye have the mind of Christ. That is what will produce the unity. Because if there is not humility and subjection as under the lordship of Christ, we will not be in a frame of mind to even think about headship and the direction that everyone should go, or the direction that all would move in.
You have mentioned in Philippians 2, the one mind connected with the mind which was in the Christ Jesus. That's a subject matter which is of very high interest and very great interest in all along Philippians. There are at least seven places where either it's the mind or the thoughts of thinking. And there is exhortation to be one mind. And the apostle was weeping because some had earthly thought. And there is an indication that there should be a total renewal of the soul, which is connected with when we are occupied with things of good things, valuable, holy. I don't remember exactly the name. It's in chapter 4. That's 10, around like that. And really, we have to think that this one mind, the Christ Jesus, involves a total renewal of the thoughts.
Good night.
Brother Reverend.
The meaning of the word mind in verse 13 is probably an opinion. It's not the faculty of thinking, nor is it the attitude of mind, but it's a common, they're agreeing on their opinion.
Political.
Yeah. But then at the present time, there is a difficulty to arrive at one mind in regard of the unification of the currency, which I think is a precursor to the sort of one mind that is going to exist in that system, which perhaps will emerge into the dominant element that would come in the tribulation period.
Mm-hmm. I do think, you see, and Martin would agree, you see, that it's that sort of wheeling dealing that's going on. Who's got power? That's the a common expression, we've got the clout, you see. And sadly, that is coming in on the meeting, isn't it? We're looking to learn, who's got the clout? Who can we influence? You know, who? And that's the way, and that's not the way we get the mind of Christ. It's to be down at his feet. That attitude of mind, that way of thinking that Daniel's been saying, it's from that. That's how we get one mind. We don't get it by dealing and dealing. And now we should be looking at these things and saying that is not the way for us as Christians.
Sadly, very sadly, we're getting to the end of the week. But wouldn't it be good just to notice the verse with which we close our section? Whatever might be the opposition, making war with the Lamb. What audacity, we might say. The Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And notice what follows, and they that are with him are called and chosen. Now I suggest, Brother Brethren, that in all the confusion that exists, either future or present, it's a wonderful conclusion for our present studies. The Lamb shall overcome. What is his position? Lord of lords, King of kings. And there's a company with him. Notice the expression, with him. Called. Chosen. And faithful. I think those are very precious words.
It's a super good expression of his supremacy. That if they are lords, he's lord of them. If they are king, he's king of them.